Hey, Betty.
Hi. Wait, Brad.
Yes.
What were we texting about before when I said you must tell me this story on air?
Oh, Boogie Nights.
Yeah. So I send you a GIF, of Dirk Diggler doing his little drop kick.
Right.
And you text me, did I ever tell you about my contributions to that film and hitting on Roller Girl's stand-in, which failed miserably? So you made a pass at Heather Graham's stand-in during the filming of Boogie Nights? Like, how the fuck did this happen?
Who was was hotter than Heather Graham, believe it or not.
And I got to assume she was a good, 6 inches taller than you.
Yeah, whatever height Heather Graham is.
Yeah. So wait, how did this, tell me, please, regale me. How did this come to pass?
All right. When I was living in LA, my best friend was working in the film business. He'd done some pretty cool films. And
doing what? Like production or something?
Art department.
Okay.
You know, back end credits. He has some art directing credits for the beginning of some other films. I forget what you call it, but when your name comes at the top of the film, he's got
right.
But there's smaller films, a couple of Jarmusch films that he did.
Cool.
But so he hadn't done any films in a while. He'd been doing a lot of commercials and advertising. And he came home one afternoon, and we're having a beer, and he's talking about, I just went to this meeting about a new film that I might take on. I'm like, what's it about? He's like, well, it's weird. It's about the porn industry in the 70s, but it's not a porn film. And it has Marky Mark and Burt Reynolds, both of who were not cool.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's like...
That film launched Mark Wahlberg into a real actor.
Yeah, and it kind of rebranded Burt Reynolds. Yeah.
Yeah, it totally did. And I just I literally did a spit take and I was like, what? And he's also kind of bitching about the director. He's like, the director's this young kid. He's already got the crew kind of upset. He came in and was like, okay, we're going to do it this way. And and I was like, I'm laughing. I'm like, why don't you just get another commercial, dude? This sounds like a nightmare.
Uh-huh. Right.
First time director, a couple of has-beens and a plot line that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. This is kind of lending itself. This could be a B movie even
Yeah. I couldn't envision whatever.
Right.
So they, whatever. He takes the film and he starts doing it. And I went to meet him when they were shooting the opening scene, which is a tracking shot through the disco.
Yeah,
it starts
and
pans down the sign and then they go in.
It's Paul Thomas Anderson's homage to Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Follow him all through the disco.
That's right.
I was sitting right above the doorway. That was because the thing is the shot goes everywhere. So
you're an extra in the discotheque scene, the opening
scene. I'm not in the shot. I was in the
there.
Only place. I was in this balcony above the entrance, which was the only place you could be out of the shot because the shot goes everywhere.
Mm.
There's no hidden angles where you can hide from the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So I was up there for all the takes for that shot, which is pretty long.
Right.
And but I was sitting next to the...
So you're watching all this play out. You're watching them move through the disco, Bert's at the table.
Yeah, all of that.
The whole deal. Cool.
But the funniest part is I'm also watching it. People are dancing. And what they would do, because all the music goes in post, right? You can't have music while you're filming.
Oh, right. So it's a silent disco down there?
Yeah. There's five or six people who are scattered around who are clapping and keeping the beat so that people know a tempo to dance to.
Cool.
And they're the beat keepers. And so it's a silent, it's silent except for five people clapping and
some clap metronome going on.
Yeah. There's nobody's talking.
Yeah. Yeah. How weird. How cool.
But I was sitting right next to the stand-in for Heather Graham, she was gorgeous. But I had just moved out there from New York. I was still in the Goops. I thought I was a big deal. I was not a big deal.
Explains it. Was this your skinny tie phase from the last episode?
No.
Okay.
This is more my shiny pants phase.
Okay. So you came in what? Hot shit? Just hey.
I had my bleached hair. I thought I was hot shit. And I thought I was still a guy who mattered in a band. And
You looked like Puck from the real world.
She wasn't interested at all.
No, not interested. Well, that is a nice claim to fame, though.
I actually did work on the film because at another point when it got going, he came home one day and he's bitching about the artist that he'd hired to do like all the 2D stuff. He's like, we have to remake a whole like porn store. We have to make all these fake VCR covers, and he's like showing me some of this stuff. And I'm like, whoa, I'm like, I can do better than that on my laptop.
So you got to do like fake, like Debbie Does Dallas covers. Like,
yeah, you got to make up like the titles and whatever, wherever they get.
That's kind of fun. How many did you do?
So I didn't actually end up doing those. She had already finished them, but I did all the posters on his wall that his mom rips off.
No way.
Yeah, there's like 2 Corvette posters on his wall.
Yeah. That's
there's
right.
2 different ones. Like one, I think, says USA on it. And then the other one was just like pink. And the thing is like I never saved the files for him. So we made like 3 or 4 copies of these big posters.
You could totally recreate those and make money. People love that movie.
They were digital prints. If I still had the original files, I could just print them out
just
and be like,
fake it. Those are not hard images to duplicate. Come on, Brad. Oh, wow.
Probably not. That.
But you didn't get the glad hand with Paul Thomas Anderson or anyone like that. Did you see him working?
Yeah.
Like, what was the vibe down there? Was he like a loud and kind of boisterous or just behind the screen kind of guy?
That was the only time I think I went to the set, and that was the biggest production on the, you know what I mean? Like there was the most people involved. So I think he was outside the whole time, or maybe he was actually following the camera.
Right. That would make sense.
I think he was behind, because like there's the only place you could see what was going on was literally be behind the cameraman.
Yeah, that's
or
right.
Be up in this friggin' balcony that I was in.
Right. No, he must have been behind the monitor for that.
Yeah.
For that shot. Cause you had to, that's one of those crazy shots where all the, little cues have to come together at the same time. One of those awesome movie made. I can't believe you were there for that. That's like
I know.
A very, very critical scene in movie history. Look at that, Brad. You got these funny receipts coming at me all the time. And what I love about you is you're never just sitting around being like, yeah, you know what happened to me? It's always in some situation where you're like, oh yeah, did I ever tell you the time when I like hit on Heather Graham standing? This is why I wear the replacements of podcasts.
For real.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason. Well, speaking of which, on that great story, when I'm doing research for this podcast, I'm listening to, Jeremy Bohm from Touche Amore interview Ryan just to try to, and you know what, like he's got all these ads. He's got jingles. He's reading stuff. And you know what he does? He talks about the Patreon in the intro, not the outro, right?
Okay.
Which probably makes sense. So just if anyone's here, hi, we have a Patreon,
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
And you can go do stuff on there, see, I hate it though. This is why we're the replacements. But, Jeremy, I'm looking at you, kid. Remember, I had you on Going Off Track. And guess who he had on his podcast? Brian Fallon. I get it. I get what you're doing. I understand. You want the clicks, but what the fuck, man? You start a podcast. This is my space. You can't even have me on. Jesus Christ. Oh, this is drummer hatred out there,
Oh, Benny.
So anyway, Ryan Patterson, great guy. I don't know him personally, but I've been just like getting into this, and somebody off the bat, it's like the receipts are so long. I forgot he had so many damn receipts, like how many bands he's been in and how many cool things from that scene he's been involved with. Even when I'm talking to my friend Andy beforehand, Andy Tinsley, who gave me some information, and he's like, yeah, he was part of doing Crazy Fest. And Crazy Fest was a really big deal to like our scene. And like, it was one of the only like major, US music festivals for this kind of music. And he was behind that. I didn't even talk about one of the biggest breaks in my young musical life was the Low End Theory getting our song on an initial record sampler. You know, like just, you know, those samplers, the labels would do with like 25 songs and stuff. Yeah. And like getting on that, it was a big deal, you know, at the time. So like he's just had his hands in things forever. And that's why I was so keen on kind of understanding the mindset of like, you know, he's one of the people we talk to that has truly from the get-go to now just lived an independently creative life, you know, without sustaining in other ways and always finding different avenues to stay creative and stay relevant. And I really like, I don't know. It's just such a, it's like the commendable journey, you know, like everyone's journey is different, but I always just appreciate people who can never go past that point. A lot of people have to go past to get what they want and still get what they want and stay creative and be able to, you know, not have to answer to anybody and actually still do what you want. It's a really cool and unique space as an artist to be in, you know? So I think people would be, it'd be smart to listen to the words of Ryan and what he dropped on us in this interview, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. 'Cause he appreciates it too.
He does.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Why don't we get into it?
Let's do it.
Play the train.
It's going on track!
Hi, Ryan.
Howdy. How you guys doing?
We've never met in person, right? Or have we?
I don't think so. I don't know.
I have a weird memory of playing a show together in Texas, perhaps, with like the Riverboat Gamblers or something like that. Is this, does this ring any kind of bell? Was that Coliseum?
Coliseum did do some shows with Riverboat Gamblers in Texas.
Do you remember one with Gaslight Anthem? Or early on?
Now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like we were in Florida with Riverboat Gamblers, maybe like anywhere, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Same thing. Or maybe I wound up at the show or something, but I saw you guys down there. It was with Strike Anywhere, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. Weird. Not a good way to start an interview. But I was just on the phone with, you know, when I was, sometimes I try to like dig into the past when I have a guest on, especially someone I don't know very well. So when I think of Louisville, I think of my man, Andy Tinsley.
All right, nice.
From touring over the years. And, you know, I'm just like, so I just got off the phone with Andy, getting like some insight on the history of Louisville.
All right.
What's great is like, shit, man, I always liked Coliseum. I've been a fan for a long time. And it's one of the reasons I was like stoked to do the interview, stoked you're doing shows. And then I start digging into... Man, I did not know about like your history, your deep history in the Louisville scene and some stuff that I really care about. Like, so the whole initial records thing was, you know, massive for me back in those days. And I didn't realize you were working at the label during a super critical time, right?
In the
evolution of not just Louisville music, but even, you know, kind of like our scene nationally. Like that was, it was a big deal at that time.
Yeah, it was huge. That was the turning point in my young life into the road I'm on now, you know.
It was working at Initial.
Yeah.
So how'd you get your foot in the door at Initial at that time? And like what, like around what age?
I think I started working there when I was 20 or 21. And that would have been the late 90s. And I had been, I grew up in a small town about an hour south of Louisville called Elizabethtown.
Oh yeah, I want to talk about that also. As a Cameron Crowe junkie, there's no way I'm getting out of this interview without talking about Elizabethtown.
I'll give you what I know.
We'll get there later.
Connection. Yeah. But so like, yeah, I was just doing bands, you know, I discovered punk and hardcore separately and then realized there was a Louisville scene. So I got into Endpoint and Falling Forward and Guilt.
Yes, yes.
Went to those shows, gave those guys demo tapes. And of course, all those bands were on Initial, or a lot of them were. And
you were giving them demos for like the bands you were in at the time.
Yes, yeah. Like my high school band was called Synapsis. Sure. And so, and then there was another Louisville band called Enkindle.
Yes.
And I would bring all those bands down to my little town and they would come play.
What kind of venue did you have there?
Oh, just DIY spaces. Like the first big show we did was at a Knights of Columbus Hall.
Yes, the KOC.
Yeah, and so it was like, if I recall correctly, one of my bands opened and then like three Louisville bands and a Detroit band played, and then my main band headlined. But
you doubled it.
Yeah, I doubled it up. And because we were kids and our band was kind of popular in our hometown with our friends, so we thought, well, we should play last because we don't want like the local kids to leave after Falling Forward and Guilt.
Wow.
But of course, like 150 Louisville kids came down and all left.
Right.
You know, so but actually Tinsley was there. And he helped me with the PA and like the sound that day. And
so he was there with those bands. That adds up.
Yeah.
Still his business. Wow.
Exactly.
Man. Damn. So, Tinsley's got years.
Oh, for sure. But then eventually I joined the Enkindles. The Enkindle became the Enkindles. I joined on bass. And
I remember that transition and to the, like, I don't know how many people would have cared or known about, but that was kind of a big deal. Like Enkindle was like, you know, we all had the empathy split and we thought they were this kind of band. And then they put an S on the end and get all kind of glam rock, you know, to us.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do with it at the time. I respect it now in hindsight, but I didn't know what to do with it at the time. I was too fresh, too green.
You know, it's funny. Like, as you said that, I had this click of like, that's probably this. I had no say in that decision. I wasn't in the band when they made that transition, but I think probably my whole life is that where like I do something and people are like, I don't know what to think of that. So that's probably like the whole trajectory of my musical career, really. But
someone's got to do it first. Doesn't always pay the bills, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So long story short, I joined that band. We did my first tours playing bass for that band, and Kindle's were on Initial Records. Mark, the singer of Enkindle, worked at Initial. I just kept coming around until they hired me. It was like I basically just showed up every day.
Yeah.
Until I started getting a paycheck. And
that's awesome.
Then was there for years. I after the first Crazy Fest, I helped book and run all the different Crazy Fests. I became the label manager, the graphic designer. Okay.
I heard you were zine guy at first.
That was my original thing. I was like,
so what was zine guy?
Yeah, you know, to the uninitiated, you know, obviously you didn't know what this is, but, you know, fucking kids used to staple pieces of paper together and write about bands on them.
You know? Oh, yeah.
So we would mail CDs to the CDs and records to zines for review, and I would place ads and buy ads. And
what at the time was like, when you were sending out, say you had a new record coming out, what were like the big three like zines? You were like, I got to get a review in these. Was it MRR?
Probably less MRR because I think...
Well, Heart Attack maybe?
Heart Attack. Like MRR and Heart Attack probably at that point hated most of what Initial did. So...
Oh yeah, by that point. Sure.
We were on like the Punk Planet tip, Status, Second Nature was big. I think Trustkill...
Second Nature.
Yeah. Right. Trustkill was already over probably as a label. I mean, as a zine.
Yeah, that was short-lived. After Josh wrote that piece about something, I think having dinner with the Hare Krishna or something like that. He pissed off a lot of people. I forget what it was.
So, but yeah, hanging like a hex was a big one for at the time. Like there, all sorts of them. And that really also kickstarted my ability to tour on my own bands, because I was in touch with all these people on the phone and in email.
Right.
And most of them did shows. You know, back then,
that's
everybody
when you were
did,
like building your web of connections.
Yeah. Everybody did a zine, a record label, a band, shows.
That's right.
And so I kind of just took it on from there and like booked my own tours on the initial phone. And yeah, it was awesome. It was like,
since you worked in that, like, just out of sheer curiosity, like, what, how many, like, when Heart Attack printed, how many were they printing? Like, how big was that? Like, it's so hard for me to understand in like my childhood head. Cause you know, of course I ordered it. I was waiting for it. All of my friends also were.
Yeah.
But are we talking like just a couple thousand of these were out there?
Like, no, I mean, I like Heart Attack, I would bet, because they were really thin newsprint and super cheap to print. I mean, I would bet they had 40, 50,000 copies out there.
Oh, wow.
You know, I would bet a lot.
And international too, probably, right?
Yeah. You know, Punk Planet, same thing. Punk Planet was huge and thick, but still like a, it never was glossy. Hmm. And there were tons of those. I mean, Heart Attack was free as well. So that was everywhere.
Yeah,
just unbelievable the scope that all those things had back then.
That's interesting. So even like a Punk Planet at some point was making like a nominal amount of money on it, I'd assume, if you're printing that much, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think at one point, I think Dan Sinker was the guy's name who did Punk Planet.
Right.
I'm sure it was his, I'm sure it was his income at some point. You know, that was his life.
Yeah. That's just interesting to think. So you're at initial trying to get bands onto there, like, and then how did it progress from zine guy?
Yeah, just kind of people leaving, you know, like everybody was young, so, and there wasn't much money, so people would have to get real jobs, or people would get disgruntled for one reason or another and leave,
sure.
or, you know, just all that kind of shit. So I was really interested in graphic design as a kid. When I tried to go to college, it was before there were graphic design programs. You know, there wasn't computer-aided graphic design back then. At the college.
Yeah, that's when you'd see those ads on TV for like the San Francisco Design Art Institute or something. And that was like apparently the one place in America like you could go study that.
Right. You know, and when I tried to go to college out of high school, I said, I want to do computer graphic design. They put me in like computer business classes. Well, I'm sure there were actual art and design classes, but I was not sent there. So
also not in like central Kentucky too, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Louisville is, you know, it's a metropolitan city, right? But like it wasn't on the cutting edge. I'm sure if I'd been at like RISD in Rhode Island or something like that, I'd been on the forefront of it all, but
different kind of track. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just started learning how to design records and shirts and zines. I ended up designing the initial catalog basically from the people that had been in line before me at initial, asking them questions. And suddenly I had a computer to work with, and you had all these tools there, because at that time we were a fully fledged office with like probably 6 employees. And
sure. Yeah.
So I did that. And then as time went on, I was just way involved in touring in bands and active bands. And I was kind of at the forefront of what was going on in Louisville music at that moment. So I was signing bands and all that kind of stuff, which also kind of coincided with that downfall of like kind of the end of the CD era, you know, where we're like,
where
Boy Sets Fire or whoever was selling a fuck ton of CDs on initial, they went to a bigger label. All the bands left those small labels, CDs kind of died, and all the distributors went out of business. So like all those labels kind of just died within the 15-year span.
Yeah, really. That was crazy.
Yeah.
So what were some of the bands that you brought into initial?
I think my era was like, you know, some of my bands did records. I was in a band called Black Widows.
Yeah.
And there was a Louisville band called Lords. I'm trying to think of some other bands. Like then there was a lot of stuff where it became really competitive. Like we really wanted to sign Planes Mistaken for Stars, and we're always having them come through and play Crazy Fest. And then they
went
with...
Would you get beat by No Idea?
I guess we got beat by No Idea.
Wow,
yeah, I guess
Tony
so.
Threw
yeah.
it down, huh?
Yeah, okay. yeah. Okay. So, you know, like that kind of thing. There was a lot of that, like... I'm not even... And honestly, our era of initial, not to slight any of these bands, but it was the main era where I was involved as the label manager was a big step, a big, I don't know, like a lower tier of people knowing who the bands were. Like sure. we did a great band called Criteria that was Steven from Cursive's new
That's
band.
Right.
And they're still around and awesome.
Did you work on False Cathedrals?
I didn't. That was on Revelation, actually. So what we did like Elliot's early 7 inches, and then we did some collections.
Yeah, U.S. Songs was on that.
U.S. Songs was Revelation as well.
Oh, so we did, it was. Oh, yeah.
We did these EPs. We did EP called like they had odd titles. I'm going to misquote them, but they had Hands on the cover. So we did some 7 inches.
Falling
and stuff
Forward
like that.
Was initial though.
Falling
right?
Forward was initial. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hand Me
okay,
Down was
right.
the album, and that was just prior to my involvement in the label.
That's cool. I mean, around that time, like that's an interesting insight because that music was kind of trickling out, you know, like a band like Endpoint was already, you know, pretty big and a lot of people knew about. And then this other stuff kind of started trickling over to us, which was like Falling Forward and Guilt and like the early Enkindle. And I don't even know if Empathy was from Louisville. I just kind of lump it in with that.
Well, they were from Detroit and that's where Initial Records was from. And Jay, right. who sang for Empathy, moved to Louisville to play guitar in Elliot.
Okay. So, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the connection there. So, I mean, I'm hearing this. And, like, to us at the time, you know, we had a thing going on like that out here with, like, the Lifetimes, mm-hmm. you know, and the stuff that, like, Sticks and Stones. But there was a different kind of feel to it, you know? It was a little more rooted in punk and hardcore. And then there was... It's not like the stuff coming out of there wasn't rooted in punk and hardcore, but it might have been the most melodic kind of stuff like coming out of that scene at the time, particularly Falling Forward. I mean, you weren't really hearing like voices like that very often yet. Like, what did it feel like in the moment? I mean, did you know kind of something was brewing there that was very unique, or were you just kind of too in it?
Well, I mean, I was a kid, really. I mean, I was like, when those bands, when Endpoint and Falling Forward were huge, that was like mid to late 90s. And I graduated high school in 1995. So I was
right
there as a fan, but I didn't live in the town. And it was huge. It was mind-blowing. You know, I went to shows and there were routinely 300 to 800 people at shows, which was massive.
Wow. Yeah.
But it was a time when I think... The thing that people don't understand who weren't there, and as someone who kind of observed it, it's like Nirvana was huge. So what we were doing was part of the same world of things that were really, really, really big. So this was like that trickle down. Whereas, you know, when the next wave of bands came through, real alternative and punk music wasn't in the mainstream anymore. As much so those bands didn't have that draw because maybe the world had moved on.
So you think there was like a real correlation between like that kind of alternative music going to the mainstream and kind of how that stuff sort of blew up a little more in the mid 90s?
Yeah. I mean, like Fugazi was selling hundreds of thousands of records at the same time that Nirvana was selling millions. And
yeah,
it's the same period of time where it all blew up, even though, you know, to me, I wasn't really a Nirvana fan because that was like the jocks at high school, like that,
yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
So
I was on TV
like,
already. Yeah,
right.
Once it was on TV, it was out.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, fuck that. I'm all about Fugazi and
yeah,
and whatever else. So, but yeah, Louisville, I think, was really, really influenced by DC stuff, and so that melodicism was there.
That makes sense.
And some of it, I don't actually know where it came from because like I'm like working on a project. A reissue project with Endpoint right now and going like
for
really,
Equal Vision, right?
Yeah, for Equal Vision. So I'm getting really meticulous with all their stuff and their, Chris from Falling Forward and Elliot was a photographer and took most of the photos for them. So I'm getting his stuff.
Oh, cool.
And while I love the records, I don't quite understand where they came from. You know, like the sound, I was actually, and I don't want to know, I don't want to get in and ask somebody 35 years later, like, right, what were your influences on this thing?
Yeah, yeah.
But
the answer can't be real by that point anyway.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
How could you even know?
Like, exactly. Yeah. The influences will be much cooler now than they were back then.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was cool, man. It was a great time. And it was exciting for me and really, really inspirational. And
yeah, yeah,
I think seeing those bands right off the bat, having a concept, as soon as I discovered that Endpoint and Falling Forward and Guilt and Enkindle, that those bands were touring, that put touring into my brain immediately. And like, it was fully wrapped up with right, the concept of music.
Just like people you can see and touch actually doing the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, that is cool. I wonder too, sometimes, you know, in that time, how much have we won or lost with the age of like digital music, and where, you know, the bands that were coming out of Louisville had such a defined sound in a lot of ways. And I know some of that just even comes from like, you're sharing band members, you're sharing studios, you're sharing, you're all playing shows together. So you're kind of feeding off each other with less like outside influence. And I do wonder sometimes if those like real local scene dynamics, especially sonically, you know, have started to maybe fade away a little, since you can kind of get out to whoever you want quicker, you know?
Yeah, I kind of feel like it maybe faded away and came back. I mean, I think you can trace that thing, like you're saying, where Detroit had and even maybe Chicago, but there was like that Midwestern emo core sound in the 90s that kind of spread out. And it was kind of along that like I-65 corridor. And then reached into Kansas City, and maybe like the Get Up Kids kind of came from that and made it a little more melodic or whatever.
That's
true. All that kind of stuff. And so I think that all kind of died in the early 2000s, but then I think it's back. And I could be wrong because I'm not directly connected to this, but in Louisville, there's a huge, like heavy, hardcore, mosh, almost metal scene that is massive here.
That's awesome.
And is very strongly local and seems to have a lot of the same kind of thing where there's a lot of shared members and a lot of shared concepts. And so I think that still goes on, you know, but it is different, you know. And I think for our group of bands, like, you know, Coliseum and Young Widows and currently Photocrime and JJL, like, and other bands that are part of our kind of sphere, that's still there, but we're not the people. We're, you know, we're focusing on the world versus focusing on our
neighborhood. That's right. That's right. You're not stage diving currently.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I watch these. I love when people are like, shit's dead. And then I see some Instagram video of like a show 40 minutes from my house of kids just going ape shit, doing the thing, you know, wearing the hoodies, jumping off stage. I'm like, it looks exactly the same. And there's hundreds of kids there. I'm like, so obviously something cool going on, you know?
Right. There's always something cool going on. And honestly, like if you're in your 40s and 50s and you don't know about it, it's probably fucking cooler.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. Like, if I was, once it gets to me, it's done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know. Well, before I get off like the ancient stuff, when I discovered you were in the Enkindles, I booked a show for you in, I want to say 96 or 97, at a place in New Jersey called Manville Elks. You were on tour with Two Line Filler.
Okay.
So you were on that tour, right?
I was, yeah.
Yeah, and I did a show with Hellbender and Piebald.
Yeah, all right.
At this Elks Lodge.
Holy cow.
And in my historical mind, like, so, you know, the amazing thing about memory, the further you get from memories is like, I don't trust memories anymore. I don't know what actually happened and what my brain has filled in the blanks for me. I'm sure there's plenty. So I remember an incident between the Enkindles and Piebald based on like Mark being sick and wanting to play earlier in the show. And there is a little disagreement about that. I remember like maybe someone unplugging somebody's amps. I remember an issue with like money. Like, does any of this ring a bell?
It doesn't ring a bell. And it's the first tour I did with Enkindle was with Two Line Filler. But it's possible. I don't remember playing that show. So it's possible they might have played some shows together before I was in the band, because I think my first tour was in 98.
Okay.
So that might have predated
me. This probably would have been just prior, maybe like a year before or something.
So maybe they did a few shows with Two Line Filler and then we did a little bit of a longer tour.
I see.
Later. Okay. So, but the Enkindles were no stranger to problems. And I was a young kid and they were extremely harsh to me, like hazed me. And I still love them all to this day. And I have wonderful memories of it. But like, it was a mixture of me being like a total brat and them being like mid-20s right. guys. Like, you know, their aesthetic was like that they were Hellraisers and I really wanted to be in that too. I wanted to be cool. And so I don't think we did anything horrible, but it was always just some kind of shit, you know? So like,
So it adds up if it did.
It adds up. Yeah. And, you know, like, it's funny, as you said, Piebald, like I did a show for them once. And there was like a period in time where I did a lot of shows in Louisville, particularly at this like arcade that had a stage. You just do a show wherever you could, right? There was this period of time where I feel like a lot of bands were moving into a little more of the professional route, but their booking agents were still kind of going like, hey man, just do a show. You know, like my contact with the booking agent was, can you do a show for X band on X day? And I'd say yes. And the band would show up and say, hey, we are promised this and this and this.
Yeah.
The worst instance of that was like I did an I Hate God show that they showed up to like 6 hours late. And like their list of demands, I was like, okay, you guys play and I'm going to leave, you know. But you know, and I remember there was like a Piebald thing where like somebody in Piebald was really, really mad at me when they showed up and something wasn't there. The main thing that taught me was, from a band perspective and a promoter's perspective, was just get it down in writing. You know what I mean? Like,
get the
contract, mark the shit off you can and can't do, and everybody's happy when they roll in. But
well, something really changed around that time, didn't it? Like,
yeah,
you know, I was doing shows at that time too, and you know, when I first started doing shows, if I took the trouble of like buying two cases of water and, you know, making like 4 pounds of pasta with sauce in a giant turkey fucking tray. Like if I did that, bands were usually like pigs and shit.
Right.
They were super happy. They're like, wow, you gave us food. Cool. And then, you know, we just somehow split the door in a semi-even way. If there wasn't a lot of kids there, there was kind of like an understanding you probably weren't going to get a lot. And then like 2 years later, like all of a sudden, like contracts and, you know, like writers and booking agents and all that kind of started coming into play. I mean, I think it has something to do with the same era you're talking about of the kind of the height of CDs and that stuff getting big. I think that's when that kind of stuff sort of came into play. And I hated it at the time, but, you know, in hindsight, it's also like I've been a touring musician for, you know, 25 years now.
Yeah.
And I do think that you should give people who are coming to your town a meal and a place to stay.
Right, exactly.
You know, the very basic essentials to life. So I'm not saying I was doing it correctly. But, you know, you were also booking shows with like a 15-year-old who was also, you know, balancing like fucking Algebra 2 or whatever else I was doing at the time. So Can't expect too much either, you know?
It was a shift in the culture, you know? Yeah. And at the time, it really taught me something. I mean, I may have never even told the story, and it's not even a story to tell, you know, like a major story, but I did a show for H2O once, and when I showed up to the venue in Louisville, they had already loaded in like 2 hours early.
Oh, wow.
You know, like we did like 5 o'clock load in for a 6 o'clock door or whatever.
What kind of venue was that?
It was a gay bar that was like disco nights and stuff, and they let us do early shows. So it was a very important all ages venue for a while in the mid 90s.
What was it called?
And it was called Sparks.
Sparks.
And so I just remember H2O, me showing up, and they've already been there. You know, like even though I never told them show up at three.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And whoever the tour manager was, I walked in. I was probably 19, 20, 21. And this fucking dude just punked me out so hard. Like, I walked in the door and he's just, before I got a word out, was like just hammering me with her questions, anger. And, I really didn't like it at the time, but it was one of the most important lessons, again, in that, like, make sure everything's straight beforehand.
Right.
You know, if you're doing a show and there is paperwork, make sure that paperwork's clear. And it taught me, like, just have everything on my end so fucking hammered down that no one can punk me out. Like, I don't think anyone ever in my life has punked me out like that again.
Wow.
And
you gotta give me a visual, because I imagine someone touring with H2O in that era just looking like a member of Sick of It All or something. Like, was he...
If I recall, I don't remember the dude's name, like...
There must have been a New York accent.
New York accent, tall, muscular, slim, tattooed, backwards hat, like a little bit slicker than all those guys,
Yes, yes. And those guys were into haircuts, like H2O and Sick of It All. They liked nice haircuts.
Yeah. I don't know what he was called. I was like a fucking sloppy kid with probably baggy pants on, whatever. So like... it was great in a way, because it taught me some things and all that. Those are those things you take forward as like a fucking, as I'm 46 years old now and I go on tour and I come in knowing, A, I will never treat anybody like that. I'm understanding, but I also make sure that things are discussed beforehand and know that everybody's aware. Like, you don't go in expecting one thing and show up, but it'd be completely different. And all those learning experiences were just so valuable for me as a kid. And I'm really, they're awesome to have had, actually.
Well, it's interesting you talk about like kind of, forging ahead through a situation like that. Cause I think the types of people who do forge ahead, like you did, don't consider it like a win at all, but you got to always realize that like a large percentage of people in the same situation would have either crumbled in the moment or given up on doing that as a result, but there seems to be something kind of built into you and even maybe your brother to an extent of like, kind of just always like eyes ahead, pushing forward. Like, what are we up to? Like this constant, need to stay creative and pushing and relevant with the projects. Like where's that all come from? Like that kind of, I guess, a bit of an inner confidence and a hunger,
Yeah, I don't really, I don't know.
Is that a family thing or something?
I wouldn't say so, really. I mean, nobody else in our family is like creative like that. I think for us, well, I can't speak for him. I think there's so many factors, right? Like, I feel like now and when I was young, like this kind of underdog mentality was really hammered home to me, being like a nerdy kid, being from a small town, bad at sports, kind of bad at everything I ever fucking did. I mean, bad at skateboarding. And with music, as it went on, I found my confidence there. Yeah. And I found my ability to express myself, and I found ways to really, really hammer in what I'm good at and excel at it to whatever extent was within my ability to dictate. And so I think all that, to me, it's like I hammer so hard on it because it's what I believe in. It's my community. It's my work ethic. It's my mission. But it also is like what makes me feel good. And it keeps the, like demons at bay, because there might not be an intrinsic, I don't know what, everybody has insecurities, but like some fucking badass, like quarterback or something probably wakes up in the morning and like, is feeling pretty fucking cool. I don't know. That's my perspective.
People get bored fast. You'd be surprised.
Right. True. But like, I think for us, for punks and for me, especially feeling still like a small town kid, creating your own destiny is what it's all about. And that's what it's always been for me. And and I have a really hard time looking backwards. Like, I love talking about it, but like if I'm dictated, if I need to do like an Instagram post or think about old shit and reunions and all that kind of stuff. In my own history, I just don't care.
Yeah.
For one reason, because I never feel like I've achieved an apex. I feel like I'm just always kind of plowing ahead.
Sure.
And I would just rather look to the next thing and that hopefulness and that excitement about that creativity versus something that already happened. Like reminiscing about it is fine on a like human level, but I'm not into nostalgia on like a public, I don't know, in my outlets or whatever that may be. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Like a public display of nostalgia. Is that a new thing?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really my thing. So, but
makes sense. That's the Robert Plant shit. That's the reason why Led Zeppelin won't play. And I thank him for it. You know,
that's awesome.
He did an interview recently where he's like, you know, the only reason I would do this is if I was bored. He's like, I'm not bored. He's like, I'm up in my fucking castle making albums with people, loving life, you know? Yeah.
That's awesome.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I think a lot of the bands that I looked to kind of had that. And as I've grown older, artists that I've like really delved into, like, you know, just off the top of my head, like Peter Gabriel or something like that, that I become obsessed with certain periods of their work. I love that what they do now will challenge me, and I might not even like it, but I like that it's pushed and moving forward, and I relate to that. So I think it's just that kind of thing where like you're just constantly pulling yourself out of the sludge to try to move ahead, and if you let yourself be defeated, you're just going to kind of sink back into that. I could still be some weird fucking person in this small town working at a chemical factory, you know?
Right.
I just only escaped that by my own luck of fighting out of that life, you know?
Yeah. I mean, was there, you know, I kind of wondered that when you're talking about, you know, I did a similar thing you did, but in central New Jersey.
Yeah.
And even though I took my fair amount of shit for, you know, from local fucking white trash dudes and, you know, the kinds of things we had to put up with, but it also wasn't like central Kentucky, you know, like, and I wonder, you know, was being like alternative, being a punk rocker, hardcore kid, like, you know, is that part of the reason it's more self-defining is like you kind of had to fight for it a little, you know, out there? Like, did you take a lot of shit for being that out where you were?
I mean, I think the town I grew up in was very small and pretty mellow. I mean, there were, you know, of course, when we were skating, there were people drive by and yell stuff at us or whatever. But like, I didn't have to physically fight my way through anything.
Yell the words from the 80s we're not allowed to say anymore.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, I know exactly which one. I was the same.
And but I think that the building my own world down there, like I always see it as is kind of like Goonies or all those 80s movies when we were kids where you were like, man, you know, you watch that movie and you go outside and even more so than Star Wars or something, you thought, there could be a fucking cave around the corner or, and there's an adventure to be found out here.
Yeah.
And once punk was revealed to me through skateboarding, and skateboarding's part of that too, because you turn every surface into creativity. And punk is the same thing where everywhere is a creative outlet and it's something you build and you don't have to wait for anybody. Mm. And you don't have to be dictated by anybody and you can,
that's right.
You know, and so that's part of it. And so I didn't know there were local scenes. I didn't know there was anything like that. And when I did find those things, I felt I felt like a huge outsider when I realized that Louisville had a scene and we went up and we were weird kids and people weren't nice to us and it was scary.
It felt a little like exclusionary at the time?
Yeah. I mean, but whether that was real or not, I don't know. I have friends that I met back then who said we were dicks, you know, and we were like, no, you were, right. You were with these bands. Like we, you know, they were just like, you weren't nice. We said hi. And we were like, we were terrified of you guys or thought you guys were gods. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it was probably a little bit of everything, you know, and it all kind of evens out. Over the years, you just kind become all part of the same thing. But just that small town thing, like I'm saying, that underdog thing and building your own world. And I still have to focus on that now when I find frustrations about a lot of music still feels like an uphill battle for me in terms of getting things done outside of the things I can control. And then I just remember, you know, I have built my own world. I've built my own businesses. I've built my own studio. All the things that I love to do, I can do. And I do all the time and I'm happy with it. And all that other bullshit, like, you know, it's just, it's beyond my control. And the less I can worry about that, the better. I push to make things happen and then have to accept what can happen and what can't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's cool. I mean, it seems like it all led to like a real razor sharp focus, which is, you know, not a bad place to put all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's cool though. I mean, you've obviously been DIY, independent, you got the hustler spirit, you know, like it's in you. I mean, if you were like talking to a younger person in kind of the same situation, what would you say are some like do's and don'ts you'd provide to someone trying to follow the same path, essentially the path of how do I make my life being creative and not having to do the other thing?
Yeah, I think that the number one way to try to achieve a life that's like outside of the lines is to realize that probably your creative endeavor will never make you money. And you might never make a living out of it. So what other ways can you step outside of the path that's put down in front of you in order to live a creative life and to live a life that's, you know, I mean, I don't consider myself an anti-capitalist because I am functioning in a, you know, in capitalism, but I'm trying to kind of maybe live like an anti-consumerist life or a very strictly creative life and a very ethical creative life. And when I was a kid, I looked at all my records and I thought, oh, this band only played like 8 shows. You know, this band never played a place that was a bit more than 150 people. This band, that guy probably works cleaning dishes at the back of a restaurant.
That's right.
And none of those are bad lives.
No.
But, you know, like I've heard many times that at some point, and fucking maybe now, that John Brannon from Laughing Hyenas and Negative Approach is like flipping burgers somewhere in Detroit.
Right.
And this guy is like a, you know, he's a fucking godhead. He's a guy whose voice could like destroy a building. And
that's right.
You know, but he's still got to make the living, make a living. And so that was the thing that I looked upon really early, is like, where can I do this outside of going and getting a straight job?
Right.
And it's harder, man. It's harder than harder yeah. and harder now than it was back then, because back then I was brought on to an established independent company and got paid. Whereas now I own an established independent company that's probably more successful than Initial Records ever was, but it's just one person. I don't have employees, because the way that everything works now is much harder. So
we're talking about Sure Killer.
Yeah, Sure Killer, yeah, and right. Cat Magic Punks, my yes. other brand.
Yeah,
And so, but I think that's my main thing. And I don't get asked it very often, because I don't know. I don't think kids are even, I don't think people at that point in their lives even know who the hell I am. But, you know, like that's my advice to other friends.
I mean, that's smart. So it's essentially like you got to find like almost a path to support the path.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And find, like, if you really love to write songs, well, hey, maybe you also really love to take photos, or maybe you also really love to, I don't, you know, I mean, honestly, like work on a fucking engine, or like anything that you find that maybe I can find some money here doing this. And you know, you call it hustling. Like, it's, to a certain extent, it is that. It's like, I do all these different things, and I have forever, and they're all part of a creative life, and they're all funneling into the same thing. But Cat Magic Punks fans don't know or give a fuck about photo crime. And,
you know,
a lot of the bands I design records for, they don't care about this other thing I do or whatever. And so it's, but to me, it's all very insular and part of the same thing. And like lately I've been recording a few more friends in my studio, and I'm like, oh, maybe that's, I don't want that to be my job, but maybe that's another part of this little avenue thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
And so, you know, I guess diversify might be the, like a very capitalist term for that kind of thing, but like,
gotta diversify your bonds.
Yeah, so man. It's like, you know, if you were fucking investing, you're not going to put every cent you have into one stupid thing. And so,
yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it's true. And then it lets you, doesn't it allow you to, if like one of these things just starts making some kind of steady, then it takes the pressure off the other things, right?
Yes.
Like you can make whatever kind of music you want, you know, if that isn't even in tow. And that's like, that's creative freedom. That's great.
Absolutely. And that's how it's been. It's like, I've never had, it's a blessing and a curse that I've never had to worry about the bottom line of my music financially, because I just do whatever I want to do. And, I mean, I know probably most people do, but you know, but maybe there's, maybe not, you know, and there's some, and there's concessions you have to make, and I don't really have to make any concessions.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and like you're saying, it's like sometimes I'm really hyper focused on what's making me money, and then sometimes I kind of drift into just a purely artistic focus, and then I drift right back to the money thing, and it's all part of the same thing. Like, I was able to just design a shirt for a friend for free the other day because I didn't need the money, and I don't.
Right.
And I would love to have never charged anybody for a record cover ever, you know? I mean, it's like
in a perfect world, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was when, at one point when designing records and shirts was my main income about 20 years ago, that was the greatest thing ever, that I made a living designing shirts for bands.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point I'm like, oh, I don't like the little bit I'm going to charge them is more than they want to spend. And it doesn't really make that much difference to me. So I'll just do this for free because that's awesome.
Yeah.
At the same time, I really love, sorry if I'm rambling, but like, I love reinvesting in our world, in our community. Like I would so much rather pay somebody from our world to master a record or record it or mix it.
Right.
And even these days, like, punks are owning pressing plants and everything else.
That's right.
And that's so rad. And that's what you want. I mean, I've forever said that I think the failing of our like underground community is that we weren't like 100 people in bands should have pooled their money together to pay for somebody to go to med school. So you had a fucking doctor,
God,
you
know, it's doctor.
Like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
We've all got tattoo artists and fucking hair people. Yeah.
And yeah.
Like everybody can get a free tattoo and a free meal and a free haircut.
Yeah. We should be vesting our punk rock pensions by now.
Exactly.
What the fuck happened?
We should have put it into like people that can like, you know, take care of our health care or even I think the guy's name is Dave Stein, died recently. He's like a famous New York hardcore punk lawyer.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I knew of that dude forever. I mean, he did, I don't know if I ever interacted with him, but I knew he did stuff for Revelation and Sick of It All and bands from here. And that kind of thing is so valuable. I mean, there were so few punk lawyers, but to have somebody from our world looking out for our interests.
That's right.
Yeah, so.
Trying to funnel it backwards, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So those are a bunch of things to do.
Yeah.
What are some things that you would be like, no, stop doing that. That's going to fuck
you
up.
Oh, man. I don't know. It's hard to say because I think I see people, ultimately it's all about what gets you happy in the end and what finds contentment and safety
sure.
for you. And a lot of times a creative life doesn't lead to that, right? So, but I have seen over the years, especially jobs that like offer good money and good benefits, they kind of get you in there and then you get stuck because you haven't had the time in your young life maybe to fill out the foundation to have a more free life.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get stuck into that thing and then it's hard to get out because, you know, and those are just different choices. I mean, I've had people I grew up with that I love that were in bands with me when we were kids and they went to college and got regular jobs with benefits back, you know, and they had insurance and a savings account when I had no insurance and no fucking money and was just on tour all the time. And those were the decisions we made. But I think that, and I think following your gut, anything in music I've ever done that didn't sit well with me was never a bad idea. I mean, never a good idea. You know, it's like whether it was a tour or a contract or anything like that, like I've just found that the things that felt good and that I wanted to do were always better. And the things that I thought I should do were always bad.
For sure.
Yeah,
I feel that. My gut fucks me up sometimes, though, because my gut's also filled with anxiety. So if my gut is asked to do anything, it wants to say no first.
Right.
Because, you know, it's anxious.
Yeah.
So, like, I do need my brain to be like, hey, shut the fuck up. Come on. Come on, gut. You know?
Well, I mean, that battle's intense. I mean, my anxiety comes in, like, at the end, like I always want to say yes and always.
Oh, so you come in hot.
Yeah, I come in hot. And then when it's like time to go and I'm like, oh, we're going to drive to Boston in February. You know, that kind of thing. I try to be smarter about that and let my anxiety speak a little earlier to not get me into the ridiculous situations.
Not like when you're leaving, you're like, oh, shit.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So you have a great scream. I know you don't use it as much anymore. Well, you're about to. Rehearsing, you're dusting off the old scream, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think makes a great scream?
I would say an element of melodicism, to be honest. I think that the music that I've always responded to most that had really aggressive vocals, for the most part, it was almost like you were singing through that scream, and maybe not in that way that like, I just saw the new Beavis and Butthead and there's a part where a guy's like trying to, I don't even know what the words were that the guy said, but he was basically showing, it was a YouTube video they were making fun of where the guy was like screaming like mallcore kind of screaming.
Okay.
You know, I don't know what that is called, but it was super fucking funny. And it was like a guy showing showing how to do it. And Beavis and Butthead were making fun of him on the new Beavis and Butthead episodes, which are amazing. But
I gotta get to those. Yeah,
gotta get to them. But it's it's like not that. It's like putting your power in it, but putting passion in it. Still putting
yeah.
yearning and like empathy in that. And maybe that's why I also didn't come from metal, and my interest in metal, like if there's 100% of metal in the universe, my interest is like 2% of it.
Okay.
And so that might be like, you know, At the Gates or Carcass or Bolt Thrower. I mean, a lot of like the Earache classic stuff. There's still melodicism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, At the Gates is like, I listen to that sometimes. This is like some version of pop music at times. Like,
right.
Like in some weird ways. There's so much melody going on there.
Absolutely. And like Minor Threat, there's so much melody. I mean, he's singing in this weird dictatorial talk. And so that to me is probably the main thing. And that was the main thing I always tried to get through, is that I still tried to have a melodicism and a yearning with the aggressive singing, the aggressive vocals, because when it just becomes just straight up yelling or right. kind of like death metal kind of stuff, it for me, it just doesn't connect as much.
Yeah, same. When it's just like a monotone, you know, shellacking, I only get through a couple songs when it's like that. So what do you think is the all-time, or your, not the all-time best scream, but your all-time favorite scream, and what is the current contemporary best scream out there, you think?
Oh, shit. Well, I might not even know the current. I'm trying to think for a minute, but immediately I thought of John Brannon and Laughing Hyenas. Like, I'm not really a huge Negative Approach fan for whatever reason, even though I really... really love early hardcore. Like, it's just one that doesn't really quite connect with me, probably because there's not a lot of melody in it.
Right.
But Laughing Hyenas was like his drug-addled band of the 90s and late 80s. And it's just power. It's just like, it's just insanity. I mean, the band is kind of a noise rock blues band almost in a way. And the power he puts forth is just so incredible. I think he has a voice that just, like, in terms of that aggression, like, levels me. So Laughing Hyenas, John Brannon would be one of them.
That's like a band. Laughing Hyenas is always something I've seen, like, kicking around. I've never really dug very hard into. So I'm gonna go down a little wormhole.
Yeah, Life of Crime and Life of Crime, Crawl. The first few records are like really, really amazing. There's like a first record and latter record that aren't that good, but kind of the middle is all really, really incredible.
Yeah. I'll check it.
And then now, gosh, man, I'm going to try to think. Honestly, one of my favorites, there's a South Korean band called Slant.
Ooh.
And it's a female singer, and they're really punk influenced. There's a lot of Minor Threat, but there's a lot of like, kind of like a little bit of a thinner guitar sound. It's not like a super humbuckery kind of distorted guitar sound. The songs are really catchy. And the singer of Slant, she has one of the raddest fucking voices. Like, it's one of those records. It came out 2 or 3 years ago, and it's just got one of those great, like intros of just one guitar note, and when she fucking yells and the band kicks in, it's just so fucking good.
Hell yeah. Slant.
Yeah, there's a song called Enemy that it just pops in my head. Her screaming Enemy.
Love it.
Yeah, I'm definitely a huge fan of that.
So now I get to talk about what I've really wanted to talk about the whole time. Elizabethtown.
Okay.
Not my favorite Cameron Crowe movie, but it was funny. There was a couple years after it came out, or Brian from Gaslight was like, this is my favorite movie. And I think he was just doing it to fuck with me because, you know, I'm such a Cameron Crowe fan. And I was like, I was dying to like it. I wanted it to be in the upper echelon of them. And you give it a few shakes and you're just like, all right, well, you know, it's not Almost Famous. Okay.
Yeah.
But what was the vibe? Like, you probably hadn't moved from that area long before they started making this movie and filming out there. Like, did people know about it?
Well, I was long gone from Elizabethtown at that time, but I mean, Louisville is very, very close. It's 45 miles.
Oh,
right.
So,
I only saw the movie once. I saw it in the theater. it was one of those weird things where it felt like Cameron Crowe discovered My Morning Jacket and was like, and one of those old man moves of like, you know, this is where it's happening. You know, he'd done Singles and he was like,
yeah.
You know, when like old people that are a little out of touch discover a band.
Yeah. It's like he bought his first like blazer with the patches on the elbows. Yeah.
Yes. He got his first fucking corduroy jacket.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh fuck, I got to get down there. But he's like, Louisville's a little too cool. We're going to go down this small town. And I mean, there's nothing that, no offense to anybody that still lives in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. My mom still lives there. There's nothing that goes on down there. It's just like a few miles of highway where there's some people live, right? Like it's,
right.
There's jobs. It's a small town, but like.
We're talking post office.
Yeah. I mean, it's
the basics. And
it's got all the shit a small town has, but it's, there's not like a culture there. You know, there's bands. There's just not a thing there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a hub of culture. It's not where artists are going to kind of like make their music. I don't think My Morning Jacket has any connection to there. Like, you know, if there was some kind of Kentucky romanticism, like Bonnie Prince Billy lived there or something, he does not. He lives in Louisville. So, you know, so I saw it with a great amount of skepticism.
Sure.
And like anything you see filmed in your area, it's like they're in my little shitty hometown, kind of turn around a corner, and then they're in Louisville. So there's this, I kind of love seeing that in films where you can see the geography and how like completely false it is.
Oh, dude, it's like the intro to Sopranos.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Drives me fucking nuts. I'm like, wait, you were just at exit 9. Now you're up at 15? What just happened?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Famously, the beginning of Stripes with Bill Murray is filmed in Louisville. And then the rest of it's filmed in Fort Knox, which is kind of between Louisville. Oh, is the
beginning Louisville? Like when before they go out?
Yes. And so it's amazing. I always thought it
was like Chicago or something. Yeah.
No, it's like amazing snapshot because the rest of it is filmed in Kentucky and Fort Knox. And
okay.
But it's amazing snapshot of downtown Louisville. Like that club I was mentioning earlier, Sparks, is right down there. But there's a part where he turns to go on the bridge to go to the airport when he abandons the cab. Mm-hmm. And he's going north. He's going to Indianapolis, the exact opposite way of the airport. But yeah, that kind of thing. I love it.
Just so, a better shot.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if Cameron Crowe did it just for the name of the movie. It's like, you know, just to be able to call it Elizabethtown has like, you know, a nice like kind of ring to it. Because, you know, I read it said, despite the film's title, most of the small town scenes were filmed in Versailles, Kentucky.
Oh, okay.
Only two scenes portraying distinctive landmarks were filmed in Elizabethtown because many of its historic buildings have been replaced by chain stores and urban sprawl.
Yeah, exactly.
And a few scenes were filmed in LaGrange.
Okay, LaGrange is like a little rural town outside of Louisville.
Yeah.
They call it Versailles. You know, in Kentucky speak, of course. Yeah.
Versailles, Kentucky. Yeah. I got
and
you.
That's right next to Lexington, which is where my brother and I were born.
Okay.
Which is where the University of Kentucky is. So
I can't imagine Orlando Bloom had a very good Kentuckian accent.
No, I don't remember. Yeah. I don't remember his accent at all.
What is Kirsten, the Kentucky accent? It's just like a slight kind of.
You know, it just kind of varies. Yeah, it's kind of like a soft Southern. I can't really place it as much as I could place like a Georgian or Alabama accent.
That's way more
Kentucky doesn't really have it. It's just more of a typical redneck kind of drawl, you know, and of course, any of us that like wanted to become sophisticated at some point when we were kids did our best to get rid of it, you know?
Yeah, is that like an active thing? Is it almost like... like at some point, is it kind of like a statement? Like at some point, if you decide to read certain types of books and listen to certain types of music and try to drop the accent, like are people who are going the other way, are they like resentful of that?
I don't know. But I mean, I would say that for me as a kid in high school, probably at some point, maybe middle school. Yeah, it was a conscious like I need to get away from this. For example, Louisville, as I pronounce it, is called Louisville.
Like it's a Louisville. Right. Yeah, been corrected before, yeah.
And so I don't call it that. But that is what Lowell is like what Lowell. What it's called. So
it's like Newark, New Jersey is Nurk.
Right.
It's Nurk.
Right.
There's so, no E, there's no A. Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure like anything else, once something becomes put upon you, it's like, I don't know if you have this experience, but anytime I put out a record and if I start seeing reviews and it, even if I was like, I want this record to sound like fucking Depeche Mode Violator. If every review comes back and says that it sounds like that, I'm going to say like, fuck you. And the next record's going to sound not like that at all.
Exactly.
That's kind of how it is. I'm sure if like,
yeah, right.
You know, a Boston accent or a Jersey accent or whatever, something that's more pronounced, probably you don't want to walk into a room and have everyone immediately know where you're from or stereotype you or whatever.
Yeah, so it's the same thing. Yeah. Well, my wife makes fun of me sometimes too, because she says like when certain groups of my friends come around, all of a sudden I'm like Johnny Salami over here. Like, like it's just, I don't know. And it doesn't, it's not intentional. It just clicks on. It's like these right. weird, you know.
Oh yeah. Cool. I mean, we were playing, Coliseum was on tour with the band Kveller Talk, a Norwegian band years ago. And
oh, great group.
Yeah,
I was just wearing their shirt yesterday.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool guys. And I think somebody left something in the backstage and we were leaving and I said, is that your alls? Which seems really normal to me. Like I don't say y'all ever.
Yeah, is that your alls? Yeah.
Is that your alls? And they they all just stopped dead in their tracks and were like, what is that word? You know, it's like, your alls, that's yours. Yeah, it's like, you know, the
they
plural
all scratch
of yours.
Their heads with their Viking hammers.
Yeah. And I've never forgotten that. I was like, that didn't seem Kentucky to me at all, but it clearly was.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's hard for me to say that anymore. I got called out on that one.
Yeah. There's like, I get made fun of that stuff all the time. So staying on movies, you know, someone did quite a cool, like, LouisvilleHardcore.com. I don't know who did this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's this great like history of Louisville with all the bands and everybody on it. And at the end of your segment, it says, you likely cannot be defeated when it comes to movie trivia. So went ahead and put together a little quiz for you.
All right.
A little movie quiz. You up for
all right.
it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
So I did... We're going to, Brad.
Yeah.
What's like, I mean, we're liberal people. What's a passing score out of let's say 10, 11 questions? What are we going to deem passing? Some of them are softballs. There's a couple softballs.
I mean, with a title like this, you know, you've got to figure your talent here. He's got to pass at least, you know, like let's score it the same way you would schoolwork.
Like a test. He's got to hit 70 to pass.
A, B, C, D. Yeah.
Yeah, right. 70 to pass. I like it. Okay. You ready to go? Did you crack your knuckles?
I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm firing the brain up.
In the movie The Matrix, what is Neo's real name?
Ooh.
Oh, man.
One hint is the guy in the suit goes, Mr.
Yeah,
a lot
says it
of
all
times
the time.
The
yeah. Mr. Agent Smith is the guy's name.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Oh, fuck, dude.
I like how you just started doing the accent here. Mr.
Hugo Weaving is the actor's name.
Yeah.
Plays Mr. Smith. See, I'm really good at actors' names and shit like that. Something like this. Mr. Fuck, dude. All right, I'm going to space on it.
Mr. Anderson. Thomas Anderson.
Never would have gotten there.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
What is the name of the serial killer in Silence of the Lambs?
Buffalo Bill, played by Ted Levine. Yes.
Oh, we got a Ted Levine there. That's good.
Yeah. It's Bad Brains are played in that movie. Brooke Smith, famous. She's an actor who was in, she grew up in New York hardcore. She has a book of New York hardcore photos. She plays woman that Buffalo Bill is,
she's the woman in the hole.
Yeah.
Put the lotion in the basket.
Yeah. Mm, and she claims that she got she got Jonathan Demme to play Bad Brains or was trying to get him to play Bad Brains when she was abducted or something like that.
Is he listening to Bad Brains in that like really manic scene when they're going through the house?
I, No, I think I can't remember what's playing then. Maybe like Dead or Alive or something. But like, I think she's listening to Bad Brains when she's abducted. But I might have just maybe misremembering that, because maybe she was just saying she was trying to get it to be played.
Yeah,
on set. But anyway,
Precious.
Yes.
All right. So, what does Rose find in her coat pocket at the end of Titanic?
Oh my God. I mean, I guess the locket.
Yeah.
Is that
the necklace?
Okay.
The necklace.
Okay. The necklace. Yeah. All right.
That's good.
Wow. You're talking about some shit that I don't know if I've ever even seen Titanic all the way through.
You know what I was trying to do? Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm putting this together and I'm like, you know, it's Ryan Patterson. So it's easy to just go dark with all of them. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
Oh, he must just sit around watching weird horror movies all night. So I wanted to throw you some pop here, you know?
Yeah. This populist stuff is good because it's a challenge. Like, if you're asking me about like fucking French New Wave or
exactly,
some shit like that.
I knew that was going to be to your wheelhouse. All right.
Okay.
So Black Panther was the first superhero film nominated for what?
Best Picture?
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. Who is the first kid to go out in Willy Wonka, the first Oompa Loompa song?
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
It is Augustus Gloop.
Okay, there you
when
go.
When he falls into the chocolate river and gets sucked into the tube. Okay. What is the first James Bond movie ever made?
That would be Casino Royale, the James Bond spoof with Peter Sellers. But the first James Bond proper film is Dr. No.
Very. Oh, I love I love the confidence on that one. That's a drop the mic answer right there.
I didn't even know that.
I thought it was a tough one.
I thought Casino Royale came out after they'd already started making the movies. That's interesting.
The Casino Royale, I believe, is the first actual novel, and they made like a spoof movie of it a few years before the actual like series proper began, which was Dr. No.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fun. All right. That was strong. I appreciate
that.
All
right. Thank you.
What horror movie is the quote, "Sometimes dead is better"? Brad, music here.
Shit. Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
There we go. Thank you. I knew that thing was going to come in handy, Brad.
Is it Pet Sematary?
It is.
Okay.
Good job.
Ramones on the soundtrack.
Oh,
great fucking Ramones song.
Great Ramones song.
Yeah.
All right. You're doing well.
Okay.
What was the first movie to feature a toilet flushing?
Fuck.
And it's a famous toilet flush.
Dumb and Dumber? I don't know. Yeah.
Do you actually hear the flush in that or just the release?
I don't know, just the diarrhea.
Yeah, I think you just hear the release.
I don't know. What's
that one would be Psycho. That would be Psycho.
Oh, okay.
That's I was wondering.
Yeah.
I should have known that.
Okay. Which celebrity's face is the Michael Myers mask in Halloween?
That's William Shatner.
That is William Shatner. Well done. You know, have you heard about William Shatner? He's not doing well since he went to space.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he apparently, to go off track for a second, apparently he went to space and suffered what a lot of astronauts do, which is they come back to a deep, deep depression because of like seeing the things they see in the way they see it and less understanding what happens on Earth. It took him like 9 months to do an interview about it because it bummed him out so much.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Pretty intense, right? I think once you go out to space and realize that we actually are just kind of spinning on this little rock in the middle of nowhere,
right,
and then you think about like Starbucks cups and you just go, what the fuck are we doing? You know, it's like a whole existential crisis, you know?
Yeah. I mean, think of how many times it's just overwhelming to think about what we are as a speck in the universe. But if you actually physically saw that.
And out there. And it's not like out there, it's just like, oh shit, that's heavy. I'm going to have a scotch. You know, you're on a spaceship.
You know? Right, right. Yeah. Wow.
Can't smoke a joint up there. all right. So who starred in the 1988 classic Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, it was Danny DeVito.
Sure was. New Jersey. What's up?
Oh, yes, yes. Jersey Films, owner
he's,
of Jersey
he's one
Films
of our favorites.
Production.
One yeah, of our favorites. Great. A true hero. In the film, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, who does Ferris pretend to be while entering the fancy restaurant?
The Sausage King of Chicago, Abe. I want to say Abe Vigoda, but that's the actor. Abe, shit.
I'm just, you know what? You got Abe and the Sausage King of Chicago. Okay. So I'm giving you Froman.
Abe Froman.
The Sausage King of Chicago. Yes. Devastatingly handsome. Yeah.
Ferris right. is cool, man. He's got Killing Joke and Cabaret Voltaire posters in his room. He's the shit. He's cool.
Oh, he's got a Killing Joke poster in there?
Yeah. He has an amazing, like, short, very wide Killing Joke poster up in the corner. And he has, like, a Cabaret Voltaire poster that's like
nice. Some PA had good taste on that one, huh?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like the have you ever noticed that like Victory Records must have sent a sticker pack to the set of High Fidelity?
Oh yeah.
A bunch of like brand new like Victory Records.
Well, they did all the Chicago labels. They did Touch and Go too. So there's a bunch of Louisville bands. So it was like Victory and Touch and Go. Yeah, it's like. Yeah, the integrity skull being in the background of High Fidelity is amazing.
Definitely necessary.
Yeah.
All right, let's count it up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's
eight
strong.
Out of 11. Okay. All right.
You got like a B+.
All right, I'll take it. Thank you.
Well, you got two bonuses too in there.
And I'm not going to ask if you really like ate shit on this. You know, I was going to write the person from Louisville Punk Hardcore History to have this deleted or at least just be your brother, you know? So good for you.
Well, thank you.
That was tough. Yeah, you're holding up.
I retain that. That's very funny that's listed in my information on the site. That's
how are you well known for that? Yeah, like are you out at the bars doing trivia nights?
Yeah, I don't
stuff?
Know. I mean that guy, his name's Brian Voles. He has done that site off and on for a long time. It's actually a great resource I look at sometimes. But I don't know. Yeah, I'm a movie fan for sure. Maybe I'm just probably well known as a movie fanatic, I guess.
Anything recently you've seen that you were quite impressed by?
Saw in the theater last week, American Fiction.
Oh yeah. What'd you think of that?
I really liked it. Have you seen it?
I haven't because someone gave me a competing like bad review.
Okay. Well, I love Jeffrey Wright.
He's great.
I love him. And I've realized in recent years that I really love the sound of people's voices. Mm. And like, he has one of those voices that like really, really love. And I don't know if it stuck the ending. Sometimes the farce went too far, but the dramatic and romantic elements were really, really good. I almost could have done without the satirical elements, to be honest.
It
was super fucking funny. He was awesome in it. Just to see him as the main character
in
a film. And there's a lot of like...
He should be getting more runway. That's true.
Yeah. It was awesome. I really dug it.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I'll take your good review to the bank.
Yeah, take it. It's worthwhile.
You ever gotten into like, what if you could make a movie? Let's play the game. Like, say tomorrow you get a call from like, is Miramax still a thing? They still make movies? Or Netflix? I don't know. Somebody calls you, they go like, listen, I love the new Photo Crime. It's very cinematic. Here's $10 million. You get to make like a full length movie. Do you have like an idea in your head about where you would go for this?
You know,
what actors, directors, would you self-direct? Well, guy like you would probably direct.
I mean, I would love to self-direct. Like if I had an option, one hand, like the hitman angle is kind of like your obvious like guy movie. You know, there's lots of hitman movies, but some type of like existential sci-fi expansive person on a mission movie. I really love revenge movies. I love hitman movies. I love film noir.
Like Escape from New York or like...
I think for me, like it'd be something like Blade Runner meets Badlands, something where you're experiencing a somewhat different world, but on a very grand level and less about the buildings and the technology, but more like how would you live if you were in a more expansive rural area in this kind of future.
Right.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. I had a weird dream one day about, almost started writing a script about just like living in a world where sea level rise had just reached the point where it was hitting everyone everywhere. Uh-huh. And that like in your house, everything in your house is kind of on platforms because there's just water everywhere.
Right.
Like you're not water world.
We're not drowning yet, but we're lifting. Yeah.
But there's water like running through your kitchen, you know? So everywhere you stand, you're on platforms and you're walking through little plinths and stuff like that. And so
I love that. When you see like the man against the big chat, like who do you see? Who's an actor you see in that?
Man.
I mean, I'll do it if you want.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I was thinking, yeah. We'll collaborate on the soundtrack. But yeah, I don't know. Fuck. My favorite actor maybe right now is Isabelle Huppert. She's a French actress who's like, she's maybe in her 70s now, but she's made a bunch of movies I love, and she's just cool and cold, you know? But just seeing somebody like that who's just like a very stoic, beautiful badass.
I love that too.
Stepping out across the world is interesting to me.
Yeah. Then I'm like out of the Liam Neeson, revenge territory. It's a little more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the classic like square jawed guy detective thing, you know, is fine. But like, yeah, I really want something a bit weirder. Yeah.
That's awesome. I appreciate all that, man. That was fun to get to know you a little.
You too. This is great. This is awesome.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun.
I gotta ask you.
Yeah.
There's been a common theme in our last three podcasts.
What's that?
We've had three of like sort of the richest storyteller type voices.
Oh.
That you just want to kind of like listen to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The deep felonious tones. Yeah, that's true.
Some people have voices that you could really care less what they're saying.
That is a good point. Yeah, this is like you want to hire this voice.
Yeah, Popeye and Dan Andriano.
Yeah,
and,
good voices. And you're right. You're right. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's interesting. I've even heard Ryan talking about that where he's like, you know, now finally utilizing the deep baritone of his voice, you know, later in life. Like, you got to do it if you have it, right?
Oh, come on. You kidding me? Yeah.
You remember that bit on SNL where they would make James Earl Jones say SAT words? It's like that. We should give people like this a list of great words to say, you know?
Yeah.
It would be like, I'm James Earl Jones, mellifluous. You just say like weird words. So next time we get someone with a D baritone on, we got to give them a list of great words to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was fun.
Yeah.
Love the movie quiz. I mean, he dropped the mic on some of those pretty hard, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. He had bonuses for two of them.
Yeah.
Pretty, I would say. I have a feeling that you were going to say Dr. No, weren't you?
Who, me?
For the first Bond film.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I might have guessed it by just thinking of old Doctor, you know, of old James Bond movies, but no, I don't know if I would have guessed that. My only, like, I like James Bond movies. I actually even put maybe Diamonds Last Forever, I think I put that on the other night, and it took like 20 minutes for my wife to realize, like, these are campy. You know what I mean? You're not, like, you got to take this for what it is. Like, you're not watching, you know, it's like watching blaxploitation or something. You got to.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know,
but I actually had a weird run in high school where I read a few Ian Fleming books and I read a few of the James Bond books and they're fucking cool.
Yeah, I read them when I was like a teenager, you know, like 14 or something. I loved those books. Did you ever read, there's one, I think it's, might be Octopussy, that was three short stories. One of the stories is, the entire story is just him waiting in a barn for three nights looking through like this sniper rifle where this guy is going to cross over the border, you know, like 1,000 yards away or whatever it is. And he's just sitting there three nights in a row waiting for this guy to cross so he can shoot him and kill him. And he's just kind of, during that time, like, his mind kind of just wanders back to like when he was a kid and stuff.
Oh,
it's fucking deep. For like, you think about James Bond movies, like that story is like, it's pretty deep concept. But I can't remember if the writing was as deep as the concept, because I haven't read it since I was like 14.
Yeah.
But.
Well, in classic going off track fashion, Ryan did come onto this podcast because Photocrime has a new album. We didn't talk about it all.
Right.
And Coliseum is doing shows in Louisville.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. Louisville.
Louisville.
Louisville. I can't even do it. You know, they're doing, I believe those are in March or April. One is already sold out. They put another one up. I would recommend anybody in that area go see Coliseum, because that's a great band and a great show. So he is, he's working. This guy.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said in here, hustler, straight hustler. You know, like, this is, I love people who make their own path. It just makes me happy, you know?
Yeah.
And all good music, good bands, good stuff, great taste, and just like art in the shirts, you know, it's just like everything that comes out of his universe is cool. So I'd like everyone to support Ryan, do the thing. You got socials for him?
Yeah, there's a lot of socials. Photocrime, which is an F for those of you who don't know. Coliseum Band. Those are both his Instagrams. Also Shirt Killer. And don't forget Cat Magic Punks.
Love it.
Go get some t-shirts from Cat Magic Punks.
That shit is cool. Everybody loves a creepy cat, you know? I don't want one in my house. I'd wear a shirt with one. I just don't want one in my house, you know?
You don't want a creepy cat in your house. That's
no,
true. Or anywhere near it, really.
I had a cat growing up that I think it, I don't know, hated Jews or something. It was, that thing was scary. Well, I guess it lived with a bunch of Jews. It only hated me. So I'm not sure actually what the history was, but.
There's creepy cats for sure.
No, cats got a thing with me. They know I'm onto them. So they fuck with me. They do.
They smell your fear.
They do. And my kind of just like, I know what you're up to. Like, I know that you are transiting things to the devil here on earth. Like, I know what cats are up to, you know? So I think they know I'm hip to that. And, you know,
they smell you and they try to smell you down.
Yeah, that's it. All right, Brad. That was fun.
It was fantastic. So go listen to some of those felonious tones.
Yes.
Describe them.
Yes. Yes. Deepness. And good luck with your walls. Love you. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right. Have a good one.
See you, bud.